Time to talk some baseball here on Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt with us to talk about a weighty and, it sounds like, very interesting baseball read.
Yes, this is called Baseball, The Turbulent Mid-Century Years by Stephen Geachier, friend of the show. Steve has, over the years, held various positions with the Sporting News, longtime college professor who taught sports history and the history and culture of baseball. And he's currently an archival consultant to the Sporting News. I mean, the Sporting News was, for those of us who are old enough, that was the Bible of baseball. And I got the Sporting News as long as it was available where I lived, every time it came out. It was the way you learned about minor leagues, you learned about prospects, you learned about things that were not available digitally at the time. Well, Steve also was the editor of Replays, Rivalries, and Rumbles, a book which we spent a lot of time with, the most iconic moments in sports. But what he's done here is something that I think is really remarkable. Now, people know I belong to the Sport Literature Association of America, the national, a group called NASH, National Association of Sport Historians, is where people like Dick Crapo and Steve Geachier and a lot of people that we've had on also go to a convention, talk about the history of sport. This is about the history of sport, and it is about key players and how the game evolved, beginning basically at the end of the dead ball era and going up through free agency and other changes. What makes this book different is that Steve has researched these players' lives by reading their biographies, their memoirs, and done all the statistical research that you need to do, so that a lot of things that we might have believed about a ball player or didn't know about a ball player, that he's will have so many sources that he's hit on that can give us a better picture. And one of the examples is Ted Williams never talked about anything but hitting. His high school friend said this. The minor league player says he didn't want to talk about fielding. He didn't care about fielding. He didn't want to know about it. All he wanted to talk about was hitting, that he was an obsessive hitter. Now, he was a decent enough left fielder. He was not a great outfielder. Neither was Hank Greenberg, for that matter, but he's a pretty good player. What is great about this is it takes you from the time when baseball is really not a professional sport, except in the thinnest of senses. You know, up until the early 1900s, there are baseball leagues come and go. Every town's got a town league. There are leagues coming and going and folding, and nobody even knows how many leagues there are. There are no real codified rules about a lot of stuff. And then as people who were born in the late 1880s, even the early 1880s, start to get involved in the business of baseball, they begin to see that as America is becoming a place that is smaller, in that there are actually telegraphs, there are telephones, there is electricity. As information flows, people want to know what's going on in the sports, for the sports teams for whom they root. Sure, that starts out as the local place and the local town team, but in the 1880s, they're playing baseball under the lights in places in New England. The game is beginning to see where it can go, and he follows it. And I thought the greatest, he picked a quote from Branch Rickey to start the book, which I love. It says, "I prefer turbulent progress rather than quiet stagnation." And the good thing is he doesn't gloss anybody. A lot of them are good guys. Some of them are better guys. Ben Johnson was probably not a great guy. Eddie Barrow probably was a pretty good guy. Larry McPhail, who wasn't born Larry but took the name, was probably a pretty good guy. Branch Rickey was known by some people as being a very moral, upright, straightforward guy, and by other people, it hated him. Kennesaw Mountain, Landis and Rickey couldn't get along. You meet all these colorful characters, but it brings back to bear something that Upton Bell has been saying for years. And that is, in these early days, yes, they were investors, but they loved the game of baseball. And there were people that gave up lucrative careers because they wanted to stay in baseball. And it was, at our time, our national game. And let me tell you, anybody that believes in the early 1900s there was any other sport that had national attention, it would be boxing and horse racing.
Horse racing, yeah.
And those were the only three. There was no professional hockey to speak of, no professional basketball. Pro football was looked down as where there would be gamblers and unseemly people and hookers and you know what kind of this will be, blah, blah, blah. The college game was revered. But the college baseball game was not as important because most kids didn't go to college. I mean, when people think about great players who went to college, like Lou Gehrig, yeah, he lasted a year and he was out of Columbia. Greenberg went to NYU and he was gone. Babe Ruth was certainly not college material. And so baseball was a way for someone to make better money than they could do doing a lot of other things. And there were hundreds of minor league players. And they were abused and cheated and robbed and all that. But if you were a kid who was dirt poor on a farm road back in the Ozarks with no place to go and someone told you you could make $60 a month playing baseball, you'd be gone. I stay in a hotel for a quarter a night. Yeah, that'll be really good. So what Gates sure does is by using the personalities of the ages, he shows us how baseball evolves. We come out of the dead ball era, and we're coming out of World War I, the Great War. So many Major League Baseball players served. Christy Mathewson was never the same after gas. Till Houston and Jacob Rupert both volunteered, the owners of the Yankees. All kinds of Americans did. And a lot of them also got out of it by doing defense work in the offseason. After World War I, it became apparent that baseball could be something that solidified the country in many ways. It's still exclusionary at the time. It's primarily people of Irish, German, and Italian descent. They are Kennesaw, Mount Lannis, and others eliminate any chance for black people to play. The last black people playing in the leagues were grandfathered. They could stay until the color line was reestablished. It was a rural game. Yeah, people played it in big cities, but it was a rural game, and every little town had a team. Mm. And though, you know, the local carriage maker might throw in $100 a season for him to play in a cow pasture somewhere. People often didn't have uniforms in these town teams. But as the nation started to become more of a nation of immigrants in the 1920s, we get all the exodus from all the suffering of World War I, so many people coming. You get up to the Depression, things are cranking along, everything's going great. Boom, the Depression happens. But the Depression doesn't do to baseball what it does to everything else. And the economics of that, I'd read things about it before, but not in this detail. It's phenomenal detail of how money changed hands and how in some places baseball thrived because people needed to be distracted from the war. Hmm. The prices were cut to go. The children of servicemen would be given free admission, and to get people into the ball games, to get people interested in it, and radio starts to creep in. And though Charles Stoneham, the owner of the Giants, and Rupert, the owner of the Yankees, and the owners of the Giants didn't want radio and didn't want TV, everybody else did. And when they started doing it in Cincinnati, and then started playing some night games, and started getting TV going, the whole world could see baseball now, and that was good because minor league teams were being broadcast. And I think it's hard for people today, when we have 31, 32, whatever it is, major league teams, to remember there were 16, 8 in each league. And so there were leagues out west, like the Pacific Coast League, which gave us Williams and DiMaggio and Lazzari and these guys. They were just as good as some of the major league teams. And it was only the electronic age that sort of made it to where they finally codified major league, AAA, AA, A, B, C, D, all the way down. And the story of the minor leagues, I find the most fascinating part of this. Now, as I said, I have not finished reading the book, and Steve, I think, is listening today, and he'll know why I'm not getting as deeply into some of the overarching aspects of it as I might. But the way to understand, if you really want to understand the game, all the business interests, the sporting interests, the journalist interests, the interest in cities, people are saying, you know, if we build a ballpark, we build it, they will come. Mm-hmm. And they were doing that in a lot of smaller cities. And how at first they didn't think Detroit would be a big enough city to support baseball. And then between 1920 and 1930, I don't remember which, the population doubled. And they went from a little 10,000-seat stadium and ended up with, I think it's a 48,000-seat stadium when it becomes Briggs Stadium. And the people kept coming. It got more and more popular. Baseball suddenly said, oh, let's build it at the end of the trolley line. One of the things that helped Yankee Stadium was it had two subway lines that went directly to the stadium.
Well, and when you talk about the minor leagues in that era, I mean, up until the Dodgers moved west, the western outpost of Major League Baseball was St. Louis.
Yeah.
So for everything west of St. Louis, yeah, they might be Cardinal fans, they might pay attention, but it was those minor league teams that kept up interest in the game.
Yeah, and Charles Wrigley built a Wrigley Field in Los Angeles where a team played. And here's the interesting thing, you mentioned L.A., right at the outbreak of World War II, the Browns were going to move to L.A., and they had a deal where the Cardinals were going to give them $350,000 to leave town. They had made a deal with Wrigley to go to the stadium. Japan bombs Pearl Harbor, and they go, nope. The West Coast could be vulnerable. We're not going to go out there. We're not going to move. And so that would have put the movement to the West Coast ahead by 11 years. They would have been there. They were all set to go, and in the end everybody voted against it, including the Browns ownership, who saw that would happen. So I had never known that. I had no idea anybody wanted to move to LA before that. I knew Wrigley had built the field out there, which he would lease it to the Pacific Coast Seals, the Los Angeles Angels. He leased it to them. They drew huge crowds. One of the people, Earl Rogers, the very famous attorney who many believe Perry Mason was based on by Earl Gardner, tried 77 murder cases in 174. That's where we learned the cry began. Kill the umpire. Earl will get you off. Because he was at every, he would go to all the games. He would stand up and wave and acknowledge the crowd when they would yell, kill the ump, Earl will get you off. Fascinating book. I mean, that's one of 100 neat details.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to hearing more about it next week.
Yeah, and then I'll give it to you after that, and Steve will join us sometime later in the summer or early fall.
Excellent. More summertime baseball talk next week here on Sportslet 101.